Organize yourself for heart attack.
Well, thanks for tuning in. This is Matt Santos of the Mile High Show. You are listening to episode number 49. I had a great time sitting down with Billy O'Connor, Bronx Billy, a man of many stories, many tales, and it was a good time sitting down listening to him. He can be found at bronxbilly.com. I'll have a link to that website in our show notes, as well as through his Billy O'Connor and Bronx Billy Facebook pages. His book, Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, is available through Amazon or at his live show. So check out his web, check out his Facebook pages for a announcement of where you can catch him live and pick up a signed copy of that book from him directly, or purchase it through Amazon. And I do have the Amazon link down. Now, I am not one of those big time Hollywood type podcasts where I have a deal with Amazon where I get some kickback when you use Amazon to purchase something. But a buddy of mine and former guest of the Mile High Show, Steve Simone, does. So please check out Steve's podcast, The Good Time Show with Steve Simone, on all the outlets, Stitcher, iTunes, and on his website, awesomesteve.com, where you will also find an Awesome Steve Amazon link. So Steve does get a little piece of the action. So go to awesomesteve.com, click the Amazon link, and buy Billy O'Connor's Confessions of a Bronx Bookie. Give some support to Billy, and at the same time, give a little taste, a little piece of the action to my buddy Steve Simone. So awesomesteve.com, the Amazon link, and use it to buy not just Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, but everything you need. I have used that link, Steve Simone's link, to buy some microphone stands, some cords, and I'm going on this afternoon and using that link to buy a couple of more cords and some other little doodads I need for this show. So support those that support the Mile High Show. Now, Billy is like I said, an interesting character. I hope that comes through in this interview. But one of my favorite storytellers, singer-songwriters, is the great Tom Waits. And if you're not familiar with Tom Waits, please do so. Do yourself a favor and check him out. Now, Billy, to me, is a living, breathing, walking, talking Tom Waits song. So in honor of that, we are the intro music that you just heard is from Tom Waits' Heart Attack and Vine. I felt it fit fine with Bronx Billy. And the outro music is from Thunder Road, Bruce Springsteen. So that was a request from Billy. So enjoy it. Enjoy Billy. And don't forget to check us out at milehighshow.com and iTunes. Drop us a review. Click us a star. And thanks for tuning in.
China White, Shorty Paddle Punk. Don't you know there ain't no devil, that's just God when he's drunk. Well, this stuff will probably kill you, let's do another line. But you say you meet me down a heart attack and die.
I did an hour with Fraser Smith, KLOS in L.A.
Yeah.
He did an hour podcast. He gave me 20 minutes. I met Kelly Collin and...
I saw that. Is that where you met her?
In the green room, yeah, Kelly Collin and Camilla Cleese, John Cleese's daughter.
Oh, man, I'm what a pedigree.
There. Yeah, I'm sitting there, and I said to the two of them, I said, wow, I can't even believe I said two of my favorite comics in the world, John Cleese and George Collin. And I said, George Collin was a Bronx guy, you know, and she says, well, not really, we were from Upper West Side. I said, but he went to Cardinal A's, we claim him. So she says, so the two of them are there, and I said, I can't believe it. I says, here I am, I'm in a room with you two waiting to get on Fraser Smith show.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just the son of a drunk. And they said, well, don't feel, what do you think we are? We're the daughters of two drunks.
Yeah, and they did it in front of the world.
Yeah, of course. Cleese and Collin, I mean, of course.
Well, but as far as, like, why I'm doing the story, but usually when I sit down to interview with somebody, I kind of know where it's going to go, but I let the conversation go wherever it will. But, you know, if it's a band, we talk about where they're going to play,
right.
how they got together, blah, 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 what are their influences. I'm thinking about that after we were trading those emails a couple weeks ago, and then on the way down today, I'm going, where most people have one or two lives they can tell a story about. I was sitting there driving down 17 going, what are we going to talk about? Because this guy has too many stories.
You know, what's really weird is,
where do you go?
Honest to God, after that book, you read the book, Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, and after you read it, I got questions. I mean, I got phone calls from buddies of mine, guys that I was a fireman with. And they said, did you really do all of that shit? And I said, well, I didn't even put in that I was a fireman. I said, because I didn't have room. That's in the book I'm writing
now. Is that Mick?
It's called The Mick. Yeah. It's a guy called Mick Mullen.
Yeah.
And he's a screwball firefighter, you know, and it ends at 9/11. It's a love story, but it's about madness leading up to the love story. And it accumulates at 9/11. Now, of course, I have anecdotes about 9/11 that nobody has access to.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, I was a firefighter for 23 years. Everybody was at 9/11 sometime. Like, I wasn't there when the buildings collapsed, but I got there 3 days later, and I was retired already. But I drove up and said, well, I got to go to the dig. I got to be there. I mean, these are guys I know. You know, these are guys I lost at least seven buddies, you know.
And, man.
And there was guys that I know looking for their sons. So, I mean, anybody who was a New York City firefighter was there at one time or another.
Yeah.
Maybe not at the collapse, but so that gave me incredibly rich anecdotes. I could just call up any one of my friends after 23 years and say, all right, man, when did you get there? I got there right before the first building collapsed.
Yeah.
When did you get there? I got there right after the second building collapsed. When did you get there? I didn't get there until 3 days later. I didn't get there till a week later. I didn't get there till, well, that fit the time period that I'm writing my story about.
Yeah.
Of course, accumulates in the third act is 9/11. So I told these guys, I said, listen, Mikey, I don't want to know what you remember about 9/11. I don't want to know.
Yeah.
Just tell me one thing that you absolutely cannot forget. Just one. And I've got about 40 anecdotes.
Man.
That are just absolutely incredible. There's no way that a writer could write those anecdotes because fiction has to be believable.
Yeah.
The truth doesn't. I mean, I've got guys say to me, you know, some of the things they said to me, I said, well, that's gold. I mean, and I've got about 30 anecdotes that are absolute gold.
Now, are you finding yourself wanting to tone those down, going in, nobody would believe this?
No, just the opposite.
Really?
I mean, you know what? That's another thing about the book. Some of that's embellished. Some of the book, of course, is embellished because I call it historical fiction because...
Well, you got to weave the story together. You
exactly.
You got to have the bridges that connect.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, another thing is you don't want to introduce too many characters. Confuses the reader.
You take five guys that you knew, and that's one.
Yes,
that could be one
exactly.
Guy.
It could be one exactly. You got a guy that's larger than life, or like, the guy who owned the Jolly Tinker. He wasn't my partner out in Poets, but I didn't want to introduce another character, so I made him my partner. You
Poets,
know?
That was your rock venue.
Yeah, exactly. So I didn't want to make him. Of course, he broke my chops. He made me look like a monkey. You know, and everybody's the same way. But the thing that's remarkable is people come back and said to me, "Okay, I believe that part, but I don't believe this part." And the stuff they don't believe is always the truth.
Well,
and the stuff they do believe is stuff I usually embellish.
Yeah,
because the fiction has to be believable.
I've written things. I used to do a column up there at the paper, and I'd pull on my life experiences, and it was for newspapers. It wasn't fiction. I'd have people call and tell me, "Nah, that you know," because I'd write about somebody I grew up with.
Right, right.
You know, something would happen in the Prescott area, and I would say that my column would be that reminds me of when I was in eighth grade.
Right.
And people are like, "Nah, that didn't." I'd bump into them at the store. That didn't happen. I said, "No, actually, I had to tone it down a little, because if I wrote what actually happened, for one, you guys would be calling me, you know, calling me out right there. I'd have to call this guy."
Well, that's exactly. I get that exactly. It's exactly what I told these guys to call me. I said, "What are you kidding me?" I said, "I held back."
Yeah. Okay. So you got to tone it down a little bit.
I said, "I held back." I said, "Because if I was telling you what really went on," I says, "you know, like inside the office, you know, one of the guys, my partners, is married."
Yeah.
So I had to really
you gotta tone
make
that.
Him look like. I had to make him look like a saint, right? The other guy is a screwball. He don't even care. He said, put my last name in there. I don't give a damn. Yeah. You know?
Here's my number. Yeah. Have him call me.
But so what I did was I said, you know what? I got to show the hookers. So I'll have us go to South America. I'll have us go to China. Yeah. I'll have us go to Hong Kong. You know, like make excursions to go to whorehouse. In reality, we had a cougar line of them coming through the apartment. You know, I mean, it was like, you know, we were making easy money, and I was calling cougar lines. I mean, I had three or four of them coming every night. But I, you know, you got to. Yeah.
Did you start thinking about statute of limitations and all on stuff?
Or, well, you know or what? You, yeah. Did that but you know what? I mean, when you look at it, it's been over 7 years. That's number one. I mean, it's been a long time. And the other thing is, the kind of money we're talking about, the numbers I did embellish because you got to have melodrama. You can't have drama. Nobody wants to hear about a guy you owe $10,000 to. You owe $330,000 to.
Yeah.
And that's melodrama. You know, people don't want to read drama. But you got drama in your everyday life.
The guy that you own 10 grand with, it doesn't matter the amount. He still wants his 10 grand.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. But I mean, so I embellished a lot of the numbers. So, and that's why, you know, I call it historical fiction because if you listen, anybody worth his salt, especially an Irishman, if an Irishman's telling a story in a bar, it's just understood that this is a story. I'm embellishing it, and if you can't get that, well, then you got no business listening to the story. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Exactly. I mean, it's an old adage, but it's absolutely true. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I embellished a bit, but this story now that I'm writing, I'm really enthused about it. I think it's going to be really good. It's a come to Jesus moment at the end because the guy is I don't want to know nothing about God for the whole movement, which gives us another thing. It gives you carte blanche. You know what I mean? Like when the readers know, like I opened that first book, Confessions of a Bronx Bookie. As a matter of fact, Van Zandt, this was really cool. Van Zandt texts my friend Pepe, who Pepe's a friend of Van Zandt. He got the book in Van Zandt's hand, and he says, Pepe texts me and he says to me, Billy, are your ears burning? And I said, why? Because little Stevie's been texting me for the last 25 minutes about your book. I said, cool. I said, what'd he say? He said, let me just photograph the text and send you the text, right? So he did. So Pepe says to Van Zandt, he says, look, I know you get this stuff coming out of your keister. He says, you know, why don't you have one of your minions read the book and get back to you if he thinks it's any good.
Yeah.
And Van Zandt says, no, I'm reading it. He goes, I'm already in it. He says, tell me something. Is this guy a born-again Christian? And Pepe says, no, what are you, crazy? He says, he's a nut. He's this guy's like, you know, he grew up Irish Catholic in the Bronx, but he's a screwball. He does some of the filthiest comic, and he's one of the filthiest comics in Arizona. No, he's nuts. So Van Zandt says, well, it's a strange way to start the book. So I know he's reading it because the first page is a come to Jesus moment. Yep. Now, the reason I did that was because I said, you know what? This is a get out of jail free card. If I put that as the first chapter, whatever
they're going to follow you to the end of the
earth. It don't matter because they know he's coming back.
Yeah.
So, and it turns out it's a good AA book and it's a good GA book because it tells you you can't win by betting against the house. And it's how this guy found his way back from, you know, from the mess that he was in, you know, drugs and alcohol. I've had people give me emails. Mr. O'Connor, I can't tell you, your book helped me kick Percocet. Your book kicked me at Oxycodone. That's amazing to hear that. That's great stuff. I mean, that's like, that makes the whole journey worthwhile. You know what I mean?
And it gets you there laughing.
Yes.
The whole way.
Because you know what? Because anybody who's in AA, anybody who's been in GA, they get it. They get it. Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm opening this first book. It's what they call a tell. Like, you know, like in the second chapter of that book. He's in South Carolina and he calls a hooker.
Is that the golf tourney?
Yes, right. The golf tourney.
I've been on that golf, not there, but I've been on so many that were exactly like that.
Right, exactly. And he calls the hooker and, of course, the hooker shows up and he knows her.
Yeah.
Right? My character, Connor, knows her. And then he goes back to his bookmaker friend and says, can you imagine? What's the odds? He says, the odds. He goes, being in a city I was never in my life, calling a hooker and knowing her. And he says, would you? I make it 50-50. It's even money, right? So that's a tell.
Yeah.
That saves me 9 chapters. I don't got to show that this guy's calling hookers. That tells that this guy is a mess. You know what I mean? This guy calls a lot of hookers.
It reveals that whole history in a sentence.
Right. We call that a tell.
Yeah.
The writers call that a tell. Well, this next book I'm doing, The Mick, it opens up, which is another true story, oddly enough, but he opens up, he's in Australia at the fire department police Olympic Games. He wakes up in Melbourne, and he's been on a 3-day bender, and he's got a prosthetic leg in his bed, and he can't figure out how it got there. And he doesn't have a clue, you know, like, did he come home with a woman with one leg? Did somebody throw the thing in his leg? You know, like, so that's a tell. Like, that opens the book. So there's no way anybody's going to start the first page of this book and say, okay, well, this is boring. They're going to say, okay, this guy's a screwball.
How'd he get here?
What's going on here? Yeah, like, so that's what you want to do. One of the writer's tricks, one of the things they teach you in journalism school, is always start in the middle of the story.
Yeah.
You don't start chronologically. Because nobody wants to hear, all right, I was born at a very early age in County Cork, Ireland, you know, and I came here by boat in 1950, and I agree, you know, they get to something that's going to grab them, and you can always flash back from there. You can always they call it backstory. You can give the backstory later. But the best sentence I've ever read in my life in literature, the very best sentence I've ever read, and a lot of people, if you go take literature classes, they'll tell you the first line of Moby Dick is the most famous line in American literature. Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
They call me Ishmael.
Call me Ishmael, exactly right. Because it tells you so much about the narrator. We know call me Ishmael. Ishmael traditionally in the Bible is a wanderer, he's a nomad. So we know we got a wanderer, a nomad. Those three words tell you who this narrator is. So the essence of writing is to say as much as possible in the fewest amount of words, right? You're a journalist.
My editor used to tell me that all the time.
You're a journalist. you're a journalist. I mean, and they gave you 7 inches, 6 inches, and you had a story to tell, and you might take 21 inches, and they said, okay, great, now get it down to 7 inches and come back to me. Because that's all they've given you is 7 inches, which is what actually, I had a column as well in Gainesville. It was going out to 50,000 a week, and once a week. And I'd write that column in an hour and a half, and it would take me a whole week of editing to get it from 3,000 words down to 1,000 words and try not to lose anything. But what happened was interesting. It became my style.
Yeah.
No adjectives, no verbs, explosive nouns.
Pow, pow, pow.
Right. Explosive verbs, specific nouns. And it became my style. And that's what kids are geared to today.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear Faulkner.
Well, we were talking before we plugged in here about Twitter. Twitter's full of junk,
right?
But there's some guys out there, guys, gals, there's some writers, comics out there who have that 160, 140 characters?
Right.
Brilliant.
Right.
Brilliant.
Right.
The problem is sifting through
the
junk like mine to get to that stuff.
Exactly. But that's the attention span these kids have today, too. So my style inadvertently appealed to college kids.
Yeah.
Because I didn't even realize it was my style until I started writing another book. And I said, I'm looking at it, and I said, this doesn't even seem like the same guy as writing. When I was writing Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, I was taking some of my old columns.
Weaving them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said, this doesn't even look like the same guy wrote it. I said, why is that? I said, I don't understand it. And then I realized, well, because, Billy, you haven't edited it 30 times.
Yeah.
Edit it 30 times, and then you'll have the same guy.
You're looking at a novel, and you've been used to writing the paragraph.
Exactly. So what happened, that's why Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, I'm very proud of it, because there's no wasted space in that book.
None.
It takes off, and you know, you go with it, the reader, all the way, and it's and I'm tooting my own horn here, but I wrote it in a year, but it took me a year and a half to edit. I mean, I went through that thing until I didn't want any adverbs, no adjectives. I wanted that thing to be tight. Tight, tight. But back to the best sentence that I've ever come across. The best first sentence that I've ever seen. Alice Walker. She wrote The Color Purple. You're familiar with her. Excuse me, because most of the people I talk to don't read a lot, you know, so it's nice to talk to somebody who you know, I read somewhere only 19% of people in the United States read a book last year.
Huh.
19%. And that's scary, but it doesn't surprise me. And I bet you of that 19%, and I'm making this figure up, I bet you 15% were women.
Yeah, probably.
Women read
books.
Yeah. Men don't read books. Men read periodicals, magazines, newspapers. women read books.
Well, those other 81% got to go out and get on Amazon and get Bronx Boogie.
I would hope so, because it makes a great Christmas present and it's a good read. But back to Alice Walker, I had a habit, because of journalism school and because you're a journalist, you understand exactly what I'm talking about. The lead is the most important part. Yeah. That first sentence, it's got to grab. If the first sentence doesn't grab you, you've lost them.
You're going to the other side of the page.
That's right. You've lost them because now they got too many other means of entertainment buck. You got to grab them on that first. Like my first sentence is lost causes are the ones we pray the hardest for.
Yeah.
Right? But now you say, well, okay, what does that mean? You know, like it gives you a lead. But Alice Walker, I used to go into Barnes & Noble and I'd go around to the bestseller and I'd open up every bestseller and just read the first line of every bestseller. Because I wanted to see what the lead is. What's the lead is? What are they going to grab him with? Because it's a good lesson in literature. I opened up one of Alice Walker's books. Listen to this first line she had. They shot the white girl first.
You ain't putting that book down.
Look how much it tells you. There's more than one killer. It's racially motivated. There's going to be more killing. And just simple. They shot the white girl first. So, I mean, there's no way you're going to say, well, okay, well, I don't care.
Yeah.
You got to say, well, what's next here? You know, like, and I thought it was brilliant. I thought this is one of the best leads I've ever read in my life. You know, I like that better than Call Me Ishmael.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, it's just a great lead. So, I mean, I know I can write, and I that's the hardest thing to convince yourself. Same thing with comedy. Because what do? You could pay yourself to the greats. I'm not Dickens.
Yeah.
I'm not Clemens. I'm not, when I do client stand-up, I'm not Pryor. I'm not Carlin. But you know what? There's a lot of guys out there making a buck that ain't either.
Yeah.
It's just like playing golf. You ain't Tiger Woods. You ain't never going to be Tiger Woods. That doesn't mean you shouldn't play golf.
Yeah. I heard a quote. I was listening to something the other day. Kevin Nealon, comic.
I know
SNL
Kevin Nealon.
Veteran.
He used to bet with me.
What?
I swear to God.
He was talking about the first time he saw Robin Williams on stage at a comedy club. He says, most guys would go, I can't follow that. I can't. What am I even doing here? His thought, Nealon's thought was, he can't be everywhere every night.
So beautiful. That's beautiful.
Stages.
That's beautiful. I'll tell you a quick story about Robin Williams. Show you the kind of guy he was. There was a kid I used to do comedy with in Florida, University of Florida. He went to Florida State, and we used to have comedy competitions. Yeah. You know, and I was 58, 59 years old, 60 years old. And these kids were all young kids. And this one kid was good. His name was Gregory Carmanian. And Gregory's out in L.A. now trying to make it. But he puts up on Facebook one day. He was doing comedy in some dive. Maybe about 40 people in the audience. You know, we're all doing the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And he's getting stage time. He says, I look down, and he goes, there in a baseball cap and an overcoat is Robin Williams. Robin Williams. And he says, you know, I almost froze. You know, I looked down, I said, God, it's Robin Williams, you know. But he got through his set. And after the set, he came up to Robin Williams, and he said, listen, you know, I'm a huge fan. You know, you've inspired me to do comedy and everything else. Would it be in a position if I get a picture taken with you? You know what Robin Williams said to him? Of course, he said, you're one of us.
Yeah.
Now, how cool is that to tell a 22-year-old kid? Now, how cool is that? I mean, you didn't have to do that.
I have heard so many, of course, when he died, you know, it was, you started hearing the recollections and people telling their stories and stuff. One of the things you didn't hear a lot about were those that were really tight with him. Because their experiences with him were so personal.
Yeah.
You didn't hear a whole lot. Now, I got a chance to see him perform several times. I grew up in San Francisco, or in the East Bay.
Wow. So during that comedy boom.
Yeah. Well, he was already huge before. You know, I started hitting the comedy clubs, big fan of him, you know, mid-80s. So he was already huge. But you'd walk in a Holy City Zoo, and he would be sitting at the bar and jump up and do a few minutes. And just tear the whole roof down. I was working for a newspaper. Then when Herb Cain died, he was a famed Chronicle columnist, been there since the 40s. And Robin Williams eulogized him. I was there shooting the funeral. And Williams did the eulogy, one of the eulogies. And then afterwards, coming out, I got some shots of him coming out. I was a photographer at the time. And but I bumped into him on half a dozen different occasions.
And always a gentleman.
And always a smiling face and always accommodating. And obviously there was things under the current that...
Yeah, yeah. Well, now it comes out that the suicide wasn't depression. It was it was another disease.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, but everybody has nothing but great things to say about him. You know, and comedy is, like I said, you know, 90% of comedy is confidence. And when I first started doing comedy, well, I cloaked myself in the dirty old man persona, you know, which came easy to me. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it came extremely easy. But the deal was I could always get off stage and say, well, if nobody likes me, I can always say, well, that's not really me anyway.
Yeah.
And it don't hurt as much because that's not me. That's just this persona that I created, you know. But when you write, if you're not going to put the warts on the page, if you ain't going to dig, then don't even pick up the pen.
Yeah.
Because nobody wants to read about, I did this, and then I did this, and you know what I did after that? Then I did this, and I am who am. I am, I am, I am, I am. Don't even pick up the pen.
Yeah.
There's a guy, I won't mention his name, I guess. Maybe I should. He was a battalion chief in the fire department, New York City Fire Department. And he wrote a book called Last Man Down. His name is Picciano. Battalion Chief Picciano. And I was on a couple sailing trips with Richie. And he actually was inside the building. And he was one of the 13 guys that survived the collapse. We're like, we lost 343 guys. And this building collapsed around him. Like he was in the core center of the building. And it was the only part of the building that didn't collapse. Man. So he walked out of there. He got out of there. It took him, you know, they were in there for 8 or 9 hours. But he got out of there with 12 other guys. And he wrote a book, collaborated on a book. I mean, he had a ghostwriter, you know. This guy wouldn't know a compound sentence from a... but in either case. He wrote a book called Last Man Down. Battalion Chief Richie Picciano. And it's a bestseller.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys in the fire department, matter of fact, everybody on the fire department is not very happy with Richie Picciano. Because throughout the whole book, it's, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this. Well, you know what? The fire department is like a football team. You don't do anything.
Yeah.
You can't do anything without everybody else. That's the name of the game. The first thing you do when you make a grab, we call it a grab, a rescue. When you make a rescue and you're getting interviewed, the first thing you do is you put your helmet on. My company. You flash that company. It's about the brothers. Like, because a fire is a coordinated effort. When you fight a fire in New York City, we fight it from the inside out because real estate is very valuable in New York City. Hmm. So the most first...
Never thought of it that way.
Well, that's why, because the very first thing they tell you is life. Protect life first, property second. So if there's a building on fire in Prescott, and I'm not knocking those brave guys that died up there, man, those guys were, and they did a great job at a funeral in Prescott. Let me tell you something, I was super impressed. I've been to too many FDNY funerals, and I went up to Prescott, and a bunch of my brothers flew in from New York.
Were you at the arena?
At the funeral, yes.
Oh, I was up in the top. There was only like six local journalists allowed in the building.
When Biden spoke, I thought Biden's speech was magnificent.
Yeah.
And I thought you guys did a great job at a send-off.
Nothing about Biden's history before it was announced that he was going to be there, and I did a little research. But
and he did think about the kids. It was very, very emotional. I thought he did a great job. And I thought Prescott did a great job of the send-off, you know. But normally... firefighters in other cities other than New York, maybe with the exception of Chicago. I don't know how it works in Detroit, but they fight fires. We call it surround and drown. In other words, if there's a fire, right, they start pouring water in the window and they just put out the fire.
Okay. Yeah.
We call it surround and drown. But, of course, if you're in New York City and there's a fire in the fourth floor of a tenement and it's blowing out three windows, if you pour the water through that fire, what you're doing is you're spreading that fire.
Forcing it everywhere else.
Everywhere else, right. Gotcha. So it's going to spread. It's going to go up to the next floor. It's going to go to the adjoining apartments. So what we do is we call an aggressive interior attack. We come through the door with the hose line. We start a search. The truck starts a search. And then there's other truckies that are on the outside of the window, and they coordinate to break the window once we have water so we can push the fire outside the window. Otherwise, if you don't vent... and you open up that much water on, you're going to get steam, and it's going to burn the firefighters. So then we coordinate a cut hole in the roof. You know, there's a lot of science to it. It's a science. So it's never an I.
Yeah.
I never put out a fire. I've been to 3,000 fires. I've never put out a fire. My company was a great company, and we were aggressive, and we were good firefighters, and we put out a lot of fires. So there was a lot of resentment when Richie made that book. Yeah.
I've had the privilege to work with those guys up there in the whole Quad City area up there up north, and was covering the Chino Fire District on a daily basis for a long time. And I got a kick out of it just because I, you know, like any kid, I like hanging out at a fire station.
Right. Especially if it's a busy house.
Yeah. So I got to know these guys, and in my time up there, I was covering more of their stuff than they had had coverage before. So they liked it as a group, but exactly what you're saying, camera pulls out, they scatter. They scatter. They actually have penalties. If you make the paper, you got to buy a round for the whole
house. Of course.
But it was like, no, don't get me. Go get him.
And that's another reason I didn't make this guy, I didn't make Connor Moynihan in Confessions of a Bronx Bookie a firefighter. Because number one is the 23 years I have on the fire department, 23 of the proudest years of my life. And I was in Vietnam, and I understand the camaraderie and everything else. But those 23 years, those guys are my brothers. I would never... This guy, Moynihan, was a mess. You know, I mean, now, not to say that I wasn't a mess when I was on the fire department, but here's the deal. The fire department is like any other large organization. It's a microcosm.
Yeah.
So you're going to get guys that cheat on their wives. You're going to get guys that are straight, and you're going to get guys that don't drink, guys that do. You're going to get guys that fool around with a little devil's lettuce and some guys that don't, you know, and some guys gamble and some guys. It's a microcosm. It's just like the NFL. It's like any other big organization. You're going to get a little bit of everything.
People, you're going to get your
bad apples. Exactly. You're going to get the same demographic, maybe not quite as bad because of the drug testing and everything else, but, you know, you're going to get your case of screwballs. And the busier the house, the more screwballs you're going to find. Because the busier the house, those are the guys that are A positive, and they want to, you know, they want to, not A positive, A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aggro.
Yeah. Yeah. They want the action. They want the juice. And I love juice because, I mean, I was a gambler. So, I mean, juice is what I drive on. That's why I do stand up, the juice. I love the juice, the good juice. So, anyway, I didn't make this guy a firefighter deliberately. Now, the second book is about a firefighter who's out of his mind.
You think the faults of Connor would have been too.
Well, I didn't want to...
It'd be like stripping off the cover of the
stripping off the veneer, maybe, and I don't want to reflect bad on the fire department, but like I said, when you dig, you got to dig, and you got to show the warts, and you. So I wanted to show that Connor was a mess, you know, but I didn't want to involve the fire department, because I don't want to disparage the brothers, you know, it's that simple. But now the second guy, this guy's name is Mick Mullen. Now Mick, it's called The Mick, the book, for a number of reasons. Number one, we call each other, if you're Irish, you're a Mick, right? That's number one. Number two is Mickey Mantle in the Bronx is God Almighty. Yeah. You know, Mickey Mantle is Eminem. He's the man. So Mick Mullen, of course, you see a book in the Bronx called The Mick, you're going to think it could be about Mantle. You know, who knows? It's The Mick, you know? So the deal is with The Mick... He is a firefighter, and he's a mess. But I keep the drugs and the alcohol outside the fire department. Like, when he goes into the firehouse, the screwballs are there. And I want my readers to invest in these other characters. So I wrote this in third person instead of first person, which is a leap for me. I never tried it before. Yeah. But I said, you know what? Yeah, I can do that. Why not? I've read enough. I'm a voracious reader. I said, I can write in a third person. Because I want what goes on in the firehouse for the reader to see when Mick's not there.
Yeah.
I want them to invest in my other characters because come 9/11, they're all going to be there.
Every one of them is affected.
Exactly.
And the reader's got to be affected too.
Exactly. So they got to know these characters. So I wanted to be in third person. So I keep the drugs and the alcohol. I lay it on Mick.
Yeah.
Mick's a mess. The brothers ain't. You know, when he goes into work, he's a great firefighter. This guy's a great firefighter. And the company he works for is a tremendous company, and they're ball breakers. You know, which is what they do. They break each other's chops. That's what firemen do, especially in busy houses, because when you're in a busy house, you don't sleep. There's no let's go up and get a nap. I mean, because you're doing 12,000 runs a year. You might be doing 12 runs, 14 runs that night. Jobs, you know? Yeah. So you're up all night. So what do you do? It's like a men's club. There's 14 of you. You're hanging around. You go to fires and you let's, what can we do to break this guy's chops? What can we do to break his chops? It's pranks. You know, it's like, that's the deal. You know, it's, and some of the pranks are hilarious. I mean, you know, they're like, they're great. I mean, they're funny as hell. So that's a lot of that is in the second book, you know, it's in my book. But
how much of Connor and how much of Mick are Billy?
This is all Billy. It's all Billy. It's all Billy.
For legal reasons, it's not a biography.
It's all Billy. But there's another thing, and this occurred to me as well. I said, you know what? Now, this guy, Mick, can't be born in 1948. He can't be like Connor because he has to be about 35 years old come 9/11. So he has to be born about 1970, right? So he's growing up in the Bronx in around 1970. But if he's a drunk and he's Irish and he's growing up in the Bronx, why wouldn't he know the Jolly Tinker? Why wouldn't he know Buffalo? Why wouldn't he know Vinny? Why wouldn't he know Connor? Why wouldn't he bet with Connor? If he's a gambler, why wouldn't he not bet with Connor? So it occurred to me, you know what? I can link.
It's the same universe?
Yes.
Ah, cool.
Right. I can link my characters without having the same protagonist.
I love that.
I said, why not? I mean, I'm creating, I'm talking about the Bronx in the 50s, but now I'll talk about the Bronx in the 70s. No problem. And why wouldn't he know if he's a drunk and he's a gambler?
Yeah.
It makes sense. Of course he'd know Buffalo. Buffalo's larger than life. Why wouldn't he know?
Connor makes an appearance?
Well, Connor gets a phone call. the guy bets with Connor, you know?
Yeah.
But again, why
would... I love that. Why would that
so now if you're reading that book... And you say, well, this is the second book. It's not about Connor Moynihan. Fine. But the same characters are there, and you're in the same universe. Yeah. And if I can get away with that, if people buy into the second book, I mean, I could do that forever.
Nice, yeah.
Why not?
You know who one of my – and I read, but I read a lot of trash.
Yeah, well, I enjoy it. But you're still reading.
But the one – and this is – he's not – definitely not trash. He's the best of his genre, but it's not like I'm reading, you know, historical, you know, biographies and stuff. Right. Elmore Leonard. The best.
Well, here's the thing about Leonard.
And his characters. I love it when I'm, you know, on page 200.
I'm going to give you a guy better than Leonard.
Ah, good.
And you can read this guy, and you ain't going to put him down. And the thing is, his plot development is not that great. His character development is not great. But mother of God, can this guy write? He can write.
Who is it?
James Lee Burke. You ever read any of his stuff?
No, I don't.
Name down. He's got about 55 bestsellers.
Oh, man.
And he only writes about New Orleans. All of his books are about New Orleans. That's his haunt. And the guy, I mean, could write about the head of a pin for 10 pages, and you ain't putting it down. I mean, that's how good he is.
Yeah.
And I've read everything I can get my hands on about Burke. And Burke said,
"Oh, I got to."
He says, "If you put an outline down, if you know where the book is going, that's for amateurs." He goes, "I just go."
Yeah.
Like this guy just goes, but he can write, man. I mean, he really affected me. Yeah. Oh, he's great. You read anything by Burke? And I guarantee you, you're going to read everything by Burke. He's
great.
But you know, here's what I think about Elmore Leonard. Now, Elmore Leonard, I was told, is the master of dialogue.
I love it.
You know, master of dialogue. Now, here's what happened to me. I've read 3 or 4 Elmore Leonard's books. But after I was told he was the master of dialogue, I picked up one of his books. And the first 3 chapters were about 2 cops in a patrol car having conversations.
Yeah.
And I was by the 3rd chapter, and neither one of them had used the F word yet, you know? And I said, well, this is not even, this is a real dialogue. Yeah. I mean, a cop, a New York City cop, couldn't keep that word out of his sentence if he was home at his dinner table eating, having dinner with his wife and kids. There's no way.
Yeah.
No way he's going to be in a partner with his, in a car with his partner and not say that word. It can't be. So I said, this is not real dialogue, you know? So, all right, so I take that liberty of Connor, and I use the vernacular of the streets.
Yeah.
But he's a street guy.
Yeah.
It's got to be real. That's how they talk. I mean, that's how we talk. That's New York. You know what I mean? That's how we talk. So, and you know what? I've seen Mike Taibbi, who's my idol. I love Mike Taibbi as an investigative journalist, one of the few that are out there today, you know, because investigative journalism is dead. It's dead.
How does it make them money?
Exactly. And the people that have the money.
When the newsrooms are getting that small, you know, the guys that are costing money are the first to go.
There's 2 kinds of journalists. The journalists that dig and the journalists that cover it up.
Yeah.
And corporations don't want diggers. They want guys that are cover it up. And if you shoot your mouth off on CBS or CNBC. I don't care which Fox. I don't care which one you take.
Which of the five companies that owns everything are going to fire you?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. So you're not going to get a guy like Seymour Hersh, who's a real investigator, who uncovered My Lie and wrote The Dark Side of Camelot and everything else. You ain't going to get a guy like that on television. You could ask a million people. They won't even know who Seymour Hersh is. Probably the greatest investigative journalist of our generation. But Taibbi's good. And I saw Taibbi do something remarkable. I mean, he did an article in the Rolling Stone, which was about 20 pages, exposing the derivative scam. Right? The derivatives thing, that the whole Goldman Sachs thing did when they robbed the $3.5 trillion and nobody went to jail. He wrote 20 pages of investigative journalism in Rolling Stone and made a complex subject like that, a boring subject like that, interesting as hell. And he compared it to shell games and games on the streets and things the analogies were there, you know what I mean? And Taibbi uses the word F when he writes. I mean, because it's part of the vernacular now. There is no F-bomb anymore. I mean, let's face it. I mean, you know, they tell you in comedy clubs, don't use the F-bomb. Well, you know what? There's no 5-year-old kid that hasn't heard the word. I mean, this is America. This is, come on. I mean, it's part of the, it's an adjective. It's a verb. Yeah. It's a
compliment.
It's the most flexible word in the English language.
My vocabulary used to be horrible. So I've made a conscious effort not to,
because you're on the radio.
Well, that and just trying to. And now I've got, my wife and I are married 15 years, no kids. We hit 20 years this year. We got a 6-year-old at home now. Complete, beautiful surprise, but a surprise nonetheless.
Great.
So I'm really watching myself, because my wife is she's a saint in more ways than one.
Right.
And I'm not. So I try and behave. And he comes home from preschool last year and drops the F-bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And the first thing out of my wife's mouth is, what did you do? I said, no, it's not me. It came from another kid.
Right, of course.
He didn't know what he was saying.
Of course. You know? And they don't have to know, but there's no way.
Yeah.
And come on, man, this is the 21st century. You go to a comedy club.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't expect to hear that word. I mean, really. I mean, but here's the deal. Here's the deal with comedy. Now, I'm raw when I want to be. I can do clean. I prefer raw,
because
it's funnier.
Yeah, it's your personality coming out. Yeah, exactly.
I could be looser. I could be looser up there. I could be me. It's more fun. Tonight, I'm at Tempe Center for Performing Arts. I'll be clean. I have to be. You know, otherwise I can't do the Tempe Center for Performing Arts. I found out, interestingly enough, that I sell more books when I'm clean.
Really?
Because I get a bigger audience, and people don't laugh as much as they do as when I'm raw. But they don't feel like taking a shower after I get off the stage either. You know, like when I want to be raw, I'm so raw that like I see them falling out of the chairs. Yeah. But they're looking over to their wife like, should I be laughing? Yeah. You know, like, should I be laughing at this? You know, but here's the deal. You could be a filthy comic. You could be David Tell if you're a star.
Yeah.
But if you're featuring in these comedy clubs, they don't want you dirty at all. And here's the reason why. I had a guy who runs one of the bigger comedy clubs in town, and I had just crushed a comedy contest. Well, I shouldn't say crushed, because that's vanity. But I had a great set. And I got off the stage, and the manager of the club said, Billy, great set. Hilarious. And I said, what difference does it make? You ain't never put me up on that stage again. What difference does it make? And he says to me, why don't you do clean? And I said, why would I do that? Why would I do clean? He said, because you're unbookable. Don't you get it? He says, suppose I put somebody in here like Jim Gaffigan.
Yeah.
And he draws 600 people to see him. And this is a family audience. And you come out and you start doing your bit. He says, right?
You do the feature.
Yeah, right. I'm doing.
Walk half the room.
Yeah. He says, exactly. And he goes, not to mention the fact that Gaffigan will never come back here again. So I said, well, what about guys like David Tell?
Mm-hmm.
He says, he don't want you either. And I said, why not? He said, because you're taking some of his thunder.
Yeah. It's like guys that do a lot of crowd work. Feature better not do any crowd work.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, Andrew Dice Clay.
Yeah.
He don't want me, because now when he comes out, it doesn't have the same shock value, because you just got a hold of me. And I'm worse than he is. You know what I mean? So you're unbookable unless you're clean.
Yeah.
You have to be clean to work if you want to work. And if you want to make money.
Unless the audience is coming to see Billy.
Right, so but that's when that you're point. A star. Yeah. You can do anything you want. Yeah. If you're the guy putting the 600 people in the seats, you can do anything you want. But nobody's coming. 600 people ain't coming to see Billy O'Connor.
What's that? And I don't know if they've got a show or a room like this, but there's a Comedy Store has Barris, the late night thing. I forget what he calls it.
Well, there's a great one out in Vegas, Dirty and Dirty at South Point. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, is there anything like that here?
No, but you know what? It's a great idea.
Yeah.
You know what? That's a great idea. This town could definitely use that. And you know what? At Dirty and Dirty, I did Dirty and Dirty 2 weeks ago for Gabe Lopez. He runs Dirty and Dirty. Uh-huh. And for your listeners that don't know what Dirty and Dirty is, at South Point Casino, which is about 12, 15 miles off the strip, they have a show, a comedy show, at 12:30 at night, and they call it the Dirty at 30. It's the 12:30, so it's filthy. And as you walk in, there's a sign up on the entrance to the ballroom, and it says, if you don't like the F word, then turn around and get out of here. Because that's what we're
Denny's
doing.
Denny's is down the street.
Right. Denny's is down.
And there's a really funny hostess.
Exactly. 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 And Gabe Lopez is a great guy.
Yeah.
But the first time I go to Dirty at 30, I'm not on stage, of course. And I walk into that green room, and it's like Ray Romano and Brad Garrett and Fluffy, you know, Gabriel Iglesias, you know, and just tons of great heavyweights, you know. And I'm like, wow, man, this is like outrageous. But think about it. They're comics. So now they've already done their bit in Vegas that night.
Yeah.
It's 11 o'clock.
Got a club up there, right? Yeah.
They're off. Who are they going to hang out with?
Yeah.
They want to hang out with comics. So they're going to go to Dirty at 30. So Gabe gets all these great comics coming back at 12:30. And, of course, as soon as they walk into the green room, he says, you want to do a bit?
Yeah.
Well, they're comics. These are like opiate addicts. Tell an opiate addict, you want a Percocet? Yeah, I do. Give me a Percocet.
And now they could work without censoring themselves and have them all doing it. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And they're hanging out with their friends. And it's 450 people. You know, it's a great show. And so I sort of buffaloed Gabe. So I cornered him. I said, look, man, put me up there for 10 minutes. I said, just give me 10 minutes. I said, I'll crush it. Give me 10 minutes. And he says, no, look, I'll book you next week. Come back. And I said, look, no, I'm in Vegas
I'm here now.
Yeah, I'm in Vegas. I said, I might not be here next week. I got a gig next week. I said, not a gig as good as this, but I'm booked and I don't do that. I'm not going to pull out of a gig.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that to you. I'm not going to do it to this guy. You know what I mean? You got to have a little integrity. And he said, I said, come on, Gabe, give me 10. He says, all right, go up and you could open up and do 10. And I did. I had a ball.
Yeah.
But you know what? This town could use a Dirty at 30.
Well, you run a room, man. Are you running any shows now?
No. You know why? Because I'm still sort of an outsider in town. Yeah. And I don't know. I come into Phoenix by accident. And I wasn't that good a comic. I still am not that good a comic, you know. But I'm getting there. I'm exponentially 50 times better than I was when I first came to Phoenix.
Now, when did you start? You started in Florida?
Yeah, I started at college, and I was like 60 years old, and I started. The only reason I started
you did backwards, man.
Yeah.
Jay Moore started with what, 16?
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, if I would have known, this would have been a path I would have chosen.
Would you have? Been as good a comic if you'd have started yet.
That's another thing. That's what Hemingway says about writing. God help the writer that never wore to go to.
Yeah.
You could be the most talented kid in the world. If you're 23 years old, what are you going to write about? Masturbation?
That's what cracks me when I hear different. Well, he's a YouTube star. He's 19 years old. He's got 3 million followers on his. Well, what are you talking about? What have you done? Where are you pulling your info? I'm not saying that there's not talented young people.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Talking to me, I want to hear. You you put a post up the other day on Facebook. I don't remember what it was. It just caught my eye. I think it was a Tom Waits quote or something. I'm a big Tom Waits fan.
So am I.
You're like a walking Tom Waits song.
That's great. I take that as a huge compliment.
It is. Trust me, that's
a huge compliment.
From.
I take that as a huge compliment.
But
I've had a rich life. I've been fortunate.
You've had a rich 10 lives.
Yes, you're right. And you know what? And the thing is, that's the big question with mine. I almost feel, and this is really going to sound pretentious, I almost feel indestructible because I say to myself, why am I still here?
Yeah.
Like, I've had 10 near-death experiences. I'm talking about legit. Near death. I fell through
a
roof.
Not a guy cutting you off on
the freeway. No, I'm talking about I fell through a roof. Two guys with me died. I've been in car accidents where everybody else dies but me. I've been in like some major near death experiences. And I keep saying, well, why do I keep walking away from this? What is it? And I'm not arrogant enough to say that that there is no God. I'm not arrogant enough to say that there is a God. What I do know is that enough things have happened to me that something's going on.
Someone's watching.
Something's going on. Now, what is that something? I don't know. Well, scientists, they say energy can never be created or destroyed. So maybe it's energy. I see 12 of the top physicists on PBS, and I can barely spell the word physicist. So I see 12 of the top physicists saying that there's not three dimensions, there's 13 dimensions, and they're going on simultaneously, string theory, right? Now, does that explain poltergeists? Yeah, I guess. Does that explain people coming from other dimensions trying to get messages to us? It's happened to me. So, yeah, I guess. Does it mean when you die that since energy cannot be created or destroyed, that you come back as something else or that the energy goes somewhere else? I guess. I'm not smart enough to figure it out.
Yeah. Think about this stuff that we take for granted right now 50 years or 20 years ago.
Right.
You'd say that's impossible.
Impossible.
Who knows what's going on?
Exactly. Exactly. You know Who what? Knows? That's. And I love Bill Maher. I think he's a great comic. I think he's gutsy. I think, you know, for a guy to lose his television show,
And come back stronger.
Yeah, and because he stuck to his principles and said, this is who I am. But when he says, you know, he gets on that atheist kick, and I'm not saying that atheists are wrong. For all I know, they could be right. I don't know. I know enough to know that I don't know anything. I know that much. That much I know.
Yeah.
But the arrogance of saying that there's definitely no God and to knock down people that do believe in it, because who are you? You're talking about the same questions that have plagued man for 6,000 years that Aristotle couldn't answer, Plato could answer.
Yeah.
You got the answers?
Yeah.
You're the only guy.
As you're pouring coffee at the Starbucks.
You got to figure it out. I mean, come on, man. I mean, I'm not saying that there is a God, but I'm certainly open to any possibility. Yeah. So my feeling of indestructibility comes from this fact that I'm saying I should have been dead 10 times.
Yeah.
What has he got in mind for me? I think until I fulfill this plan, and I'm not a devout anything by any stretch of the imagination, but I've had too many things happen to me. I mean, though, did most of the come to God moments in them books, that's the stuff guys say, well, come on, that was like, no, it's that happened.
Yep.
That stuff happened. I said, that's the stuff that's real. That happened. So it's the same thing with this book that I'm writing now. There's been other things that have happened to me. They're insane. So I look at that and say, well, this can't be coincidence. You understand? It can't be.
Yeah.
Something's going on. Now, why me? I don't know. But I've had people that I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know. Come up to me and say, you're blessed. And I go like, by who? By who? How long has it been going on? And how do you know about it? And why? But, I mean, I've lived a charmed life. It's insane. I mean, I'm not wealthy. I don't have any money. I drive a 2000 Toyota van with 250,000 miles on it. But I tell you what, I'm still getting more women than Caligula. I mean, so what difference does it make if I drove a Ferrari? I'm 67. I'm getting all I can handle. That's how I measure success. To me, I'm having a good time. And you know what? And I'll tell you something. And I get calls every day. Every day. And believe me, Matt, I'm telling you, every single day I get calls. Say a prayer for this guy. He's not doing too well. Say a prayer for Mikey. He's not doing too well. Say a prayer for... My other buddy just got his prostate ripped out. This guy got his prostate ripped out. Anybody who's a 9/11's got some kind of cancer, some kind of bone cancer, eye cancer. I haven't even heard of eye cancer, ocular cancer. A kid I know 20 years younger than me, he's got ocular cancer.
What was going through that air?
Yeah, man, all of it. And now they want to Sadroga bill, they want to bury us?
Yeah.
That's a disgrace. Yeah. The Republicans in Congress that own the control Congress, and I'm not making this political because the Democrats are there too, but they control Congress and they kick that back, and that's a disgrace. In other words, you're telling me that 10 years after 9/11, you didn't put in for a claim within 10 years, then you can't claim cancer. You don't know how long cancer is going to take to develop.
50 years from now, they're not going to know what.
Exactly. The
what
effect.
The extent was.
Exactly. You could be more right. And I'll tell you something. 3,200 guys have contracted some kind of cancer since 9/11. Now, they're not all firemen. Some of them are iron workers, steel workers, cops, rescue workers.
That happens near a factory. They're closing that factory down.
Exactly. But 3,200 guys have contracted some kind of cancer. from 9/11.
Yeah.
Now, here's the problem. The government said, don't let the terrorists win. Go back to work. It's safe down there. That was our government.
Well, it's easy to say from 2,000 miles away.
Well, they couldn't have Wall Street closed. Yeah. Wall Street had to be open.
Yeah.
So there was huge money involved here. So, I mean, now the problem is they can't fess up to it. It's almost like Agent Orange from Vietnam. Because if they say that, guess what, the air wasn't clean, well, we're dropping now, the first responders.
Yeah.
But pretty soon civilians are going to start dropping. I'll tell you a story. Did you know if you had a car, if you had a car parked within 10 blocks of 9/11 of the Trade Center, you couldn't resell that car? It was impounded?
Really?
Now, if they're saying that you can't resell a car, but it's okay to breathe?
It's okay to breathe it and have it sweat. And,
yeah, come on.
And come in your, you know, you're sitting there drinking water and you're swallowing
stuff. I tell women, I go out with 47-year-old, 48-year-old men. I'm 67. That's great for me. I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, that's terrific. And I tell them, I said, listen, here's the deal. You sign on, great. But every day I get calls, who's got prostate cancer? Who's got this? Who's got that? I'm 67. If I got a chance for a roll in the hay and a chick ain't got Ebola or AIDS, I'm going for it. You understand? Because for all I know, this thing might not work next week. I might lose it. I'm going out with a smile on my face. You know, that's it. And you know what? Every girl there's four of them. I see four different women. And they all say, I get that. Just don't catch anything.
I've never been in New York, and I don't know if it's going to work tomorrow.
Exactly right. Exactly. And you know what? I mean, what am I supposed to do? Say, no, I don't know. I don't want to roll an A. Yeah, I do want to roll an A. Yeah. And I want to write, and I want to do stand-up, and I don't want any relationships. I got grandchildren. I've been down that road.
Brand new one, right?
Yes, a brand new one. Thank you very much. Yeah, nice. Son, new son. Yeah, grandson. And it's great. I mean, I'm a firm believer in having a warm, loving, supporting family living in another state. Firm believer. I don't want them to have a clue what Grandpa's up to. Because Grandpa ain't done fooling around. Grandpa's having fun. And Grandpa's going to continue to have fun until they start throwing dirt on him. You know, because I know life is short. But the thing is, I know I'm blessed. I mean, I really do. And I you know, guys say you're blessed and you're lucky. Then they're right. I am lucky and I am blessed. But I know it. I don't have to have $2 million in the bank. I don't have to have a Ferrari? I don't have to.
And that comes like what we were talking about. You started your journalism career after the fire department, right? Is that correct? You
went way after. Yeah.
You went from New York to start it in Florida.
I went to New York. I went down to Keys. I wanted to get as far away from New York as I could.
How long were you in the Keys?
5 years.
I don't know why. I have no idea why, but that is somewhere I've always wanted to
go. It's a wonderful place.
Man.
But, I mean, the problem with the Keys is it's all full of burnt-out hippies from the 60s. So you
grew up in the Bay Area.
Exactly. I mean, you fit in like
it's
a club.
Bay Area, but warm.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, the Keys is great, and Key West is. It's just great. But you fish, you get drunk. You fish, you get drunk. And that's what you do. You take drugs, you fish, you get drunk. So I was down there for about 5 years, and believe me, I was right in the ball game. No problem. I can do this. I said, this fits in perfect.
Where did New Orleans fall in the mix?
I went to New Orleans, and I still go to New Orleans a lot. It's my home away from home. I love New Orleans. I went to New Orleans when I first came back from Vietnam in 1970.
Oh, it was earlier on. Okay.
I worked for the Teamsters for about a year, and I got a phone call from my brother.
You know where Hoff is?
There's a lot of theories about what one of the theories is the Keys. Actually, you know, one of the theories is that he scattered an Isla Morada. I worked for Hoffa. Yeah. We loved Hoffa. Let me tell you something. We loved Hoffa. That's another corporate media maligning a true hero. Hoffa was an amazing organizer. This knocking union stuff is all part of the big plan. Like they say, unions are corrupt. Yeah. There's corrupt unions.
So is the church. So is the fire.
So is the church. So is the fire.
So is the
NFL. So is CEOs. So is Congress. This is America.
People together.
This is America.
Yeah.
Dollars speak, and we all know the deal. They're the other part of that adage. You know, we know what walks, and we know what talks. And this is America. So yeah, there's corrupt unions, but there's corrupt everything.
Yeah.
So what do you want to do? Shut down the government because of corruption?
Whenever you've got a system in play, there's going to be somebody working it.
Exactly.
No matter what.
Exactly. And you know what? One of the greatest definitions I ever read about capitalism, it said, I want to quote this right. He said, capitalism is man taking advantage of his fellow man. And communism is exactly the opposite. Man taking advantage of his fellow man.
I love it. I love it.
And that's, man, I mean, that's so true. I mean, that's what, you know, everybody's trying to get an edge up. If you put two people in a room together, one's going to try and get a bigger share. That's it. That's where we operate. That's where we are. We're selfish creatures. But the greed has gotten to the point in this country. I mean, I don't even know anymore. I mean, and I'm not a socialist, but all I know is every time there's something going on for the people, it's called socialism. When something's going on for the corporations, yeah, it's okay. Like, you know, well, after they bailed out the banks, we're all socialists.
Yeah.
They're supposed to sink. How could you be too big to fail? What does that mean? Who ever heard of that? And they get money back at zero interest, which charges
6%. And bonuses.
And 6% interest to have our kids go to school? What is that about? What are you kidding? I mean, it's just corruption is rampant. And the NFL is... Don't even get me started on that.
That's a whole nother podcast.
Don't even get me started.
Hey, we're running right up on that time. Great, I don't want to take you. I know you got the show tonight.
I went flew. It flew.
What I want to do is put this out there right now. One, you've got the Mick coming out. You got an idea of when?
Well, you know what? The thing about art is you never know.
Yeah. So that's, we'll be looking for that. But hey, anytime. And I'm trying to get down here at least once a month. I was down here Wednesday night. If you want to ignore them, great, but I'm going to shoot you some messages when I'm down here. I would love to sit down because, like I said, you've got – usually when I interview somebody, they've got one or two directions we can go in. This could be the Billy O'Connor podcast.
Very flattering, man. So and you're an easy guy to interview with. I mean, you're great at this. You're very good at this.
I would love to, one, dial in more on the gambling aspect. I'm not a gambler. I'm reading through – when I was reading Confessions of Bronx Bookie, and then I listened to you. You were up at that, and I forgive me because I can't remember who it was, at the Big Pine Comedy Festival. You did a podcast with a couple of guys.
Right, right.
And you dialed in on the odds and everything, way over my head. Fascinating to listen to, but way over my head. I am way too cheap to go,
you're smart,
to go gamble. No, because I'll go draw. Not now. This is way back when. I would go and drop, you know, $800 in a night on a couple of 8-balls and at the bar, but I wouldn't drop a nickel into a slot machine because that was wasting money.
That's smart. Exactly right. You said your priorities. You saved it for the important things. I got you. And that's, so
I'm just way too cheap. I don't like the fact of just handing somebody
money.
Well,
I spent half my life as a gambler, and I threw away a lot of money gambling. I made a lot of money, but I threw it away too, just as well.
But I would like to talk to you more on the gambling aspect. Of course, on the writing, because it fascinates me. And the journalism aspect with you starting in... When did you get your first job as a journalist? What year was that?
Well, I was in 1961.
Oh.
A guy approached me.
So you came
a guy in class. Well, no, I never did it. I didn't even know I could write. Here's what happened. I, a quick story. I'll try and do this quick. Tough for an Irishman. I was in a class, the English 101. In other words, you're going back to school after 35 years.
Yeah.
They want to know, is this guy literate, basically? Can this guy write a paragraph? So I'm in English 101 class, and the teacher says, submit a paper, and I do. And she was a female teacher. Community college associated with UF because I had to go back there and take algebra and geometry and all those things that I'd forgotten.
Stuff, yeah,
all that stuff that I'd forgotten. And English 101, I gave her the paper and she says to me, a week later, can you stay after class? I said, sure. I said, what's the problem? She goes, that paper you handed me. I said, yeah. She goes, it's real good. Do you mind if I do something with it? I said, what's an English 101 paper? What are you going to blow your nose in it? You know, yeah. Do whatever you want with it. Well, I go home that night. The next morning I wake up. And I got like 300 emails from all over the world, from New Zealand, from China, from Australia, from Ireland, from all over the world. And they say, Mr. O'Connor, I read your words. I can't tell you how much they
–
and I said, whoa. I said, what is this? And I said to my girlfriend, I didn't even know. I said, what does this mean? I said to my girlfriend. She goes, you got published. I said, what does that mean? I said, what does that mean? She says, you got published. Somebody published. I said, published what? I didn't write anything. She goes, you wrote something.
Yeah.
She goes, check – go back to the source and check it. And I did, and it was that paper.
Wow.
And she gave it to this organization called Counterpunch. They have 3 million readers. And it went viral. USA Today picked it up.
Man.
So the first thing I ever wrote went viral.
Nice.
And I said to my girlfriend, I said, maybe I can write. And she said, apparently. I said, what's the quickest way to learn? She said, take journalism.
Yeah.
Don't take English. Journalism will give you the tools. So I went back down to UF and I started doing journalism. And then I started writing a column, Confessions of a Bronx Bookie.
This could go on and on. And I don't want to monopolize all your time. I know you got a show to get ready for. You want to grab that up?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I got a show tonight. Yeah.
But
I'd love to sit down because I want to
explore a couple of different avenues with you, but
love to
be able to concentrate on that. And of course, when the mix ready, we'll talk about that as well.
Well, the good news is with the first book is that Stevie Van Zandt's involved now.
Yeah.
I don't know how much he's involved. It doesn't matter. Just his picture meant a lot to me. Just the fact that he read the book meant a lot to me.
It's begging for a movie.
Everybody says that. We'll see. I mean, from your lips to God's ears, I don't know. But you know what? If nothing happens, I'm doing what I love to do.
You got it out there, yeah.
And, you know, I always said I was going to write one. And by God, I went back to school for 5 years, learned how to do it, and I wrote one. And now I'm going to write another one. And I got another one. And I got four in me, for sure.
In the holster, ready to go.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Run through it again. We're BronxBilly.com?
I'm on BronxBilly.com. If you want the copy of the book, I'll sign a copy on BronxBilly.com. It's also on Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's a Confessions of a Bronx Bookie. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm on BronxBillyO on Twitter, but I'm on Facebook a lot. I'm Billy O'Connor on Facebook. And, I'd be glad to hear from you. And, Matt,
definitely.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, this was great. Now, this is going to go. I did a show out here. I did a recording on Wednesday. That's the one that's going to hit this Monday. So this one won't hit till the following Monday, whatever date that is. You got anything lined up, or just Facebook is where folks go to see where you're going to be?
Yeah, pretty much Facebook. Okay. I've got three Facebook pages. I got Bronx Billy, which is Bronx Billy's the book, and then Billy O'Connor, which is me. And also the comedy is on Billy O'Connor, where I'm going to be. I'm going out to L.A. I'll be doing some shows in New York. I'm doing some shows in Vegas. Specific dates are all – I can't remember dates anyway. They just
I'll
run around my head.
Maybe I'll hit you up on a road trip. I'm
that
always
sounds
looking
great,
for an
Matt.
Excuse to hop in the car and go. Now, Brother, you were just in New York recently, weren't you?
I was there for the birth of my son, my grandson, and I didn't want to schedule a show because I didn't know what day the baby was going to be born. I wanted to be there for the birth. But actually, about – a month earlier, I was in New York, and I did two sold-out shows. 130, I just rented a bar, and I had 130 show up on each show and packed the room with my friends. And I never had so much fun doing a comedy show. Because I did 55 minutes of before I even got into my act of just talking about my friends out there. You know, just telling, let me tell you why I love Vinny. Let me tell you why I love the Tinker. Let me tell you why I love Flacco. Yeah. Let me tell you why I love this guy. Let me, you know, like, and it was great. I had so much fun. I was so loose because...
Yeah.
You know, it's like
coming
being
home again.
Yeah, it's like being a family. I mean, when do you get an opportunity to do comedy in front of, and you know 90% of the audience?
Yeah.
That ain't going to happen. So it was great. So I look forward to doing that again. And I usually avoid the comedy clubs in New York because they usually have the bringer thing. And, And it's.
And nothing like a good bar show, though.
Nah.
It's like, you know, music wise, because I interview a lot of musicians too, and I go to a lot of music. I've covered photograph shows and I've done the big stadium shows and bigger clubs and things. There's nothing like seeing a little tight four piece in the corner of a
you couldn't
even get a smoky bar no more.
You're there,
but
you're there
right there in front.
I saw Springsteen. The very first time I ever saw Springsteen was at the Bottom Line. 350 people.
Oh man,
I didn't even know who he was. Some guy says, you got to see this guy, Bruce Springsteen. Is this a Jewish guy? Is it Springsteen? Springsteen? Who is this guy? Springsteen? What is he, a Jewish guy? Well, yeah, okay, I'll go see him. I didn't know who he was. About 3 weeks later, he was on the cover of Time. You know, like, I've seen the future of rock and roll. It's Bruce Springsteen.
There's
but to
like
see that, I mean, I became a fan of his. That was it. I mean, I was done, you know. Yeah. But, Matt, it's been a joy, a pleasure.
Much.
Thank you so much out
and
there
I will
for listening
reach out.
To me.
I'd love to sit down with you, whether it be on the road or I'll meet you down here. And
I'd talk to you anytime, brother.
Oh, great.
You're easy guy to talk to.
Appreciate it.
Like my confessor. God help you.
Peace.
The screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself alone.